Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Wednesday, October 13th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner of the page, it'll take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that particular chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. This work is the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Worksheet. It's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and a tool I can use at any time I so desire to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click, download it, print it off, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. By the time you're done typing the word, before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon, and if you tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app. That app contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce this work to even younger audiences. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one, where people have either been stepped through that worksheet process or given powerful testimonials about that, how the use of that tool has improved the quality of their life. And if you've got any comments or questions about that, you can give us a call, 563-999-3581. And when you call that number and press 1, it'll put a little question mark by your phone number. I'll announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation about first century Aramaic forgiveness. We're also doing the Course in Miracles lessons, workbook lessons this year, and so today is the 286th day of the year. Today's lesson simply reads, The hush of heaven holds my heart today. The commentary reads, Father, how still today. How quietly do all things fall into place. This is the day that has been chosen as the time in which I come to understand the lesson that there is no need for me to do anything. In you, Creator, is every choice already made. In you has every conflict been resolved. In you is everything I hope to find already given to me. Your peace is mine. My heart is quiet. My mind is at rest. Your love is the goal, and your love is mine. The stillness of today will give us hope that we have found the way and traveled far along it to a wholly certain goal. Today we will not doubt the end which the Creator itself has promised us. we trust it, and in ourself, who still is one with the Creator. So that's the Course in Miracles lesson today, the Course in Miracles experiment book by Pam Grout. Lesson 286 is titled, Reach for the Sky. She quotes A Course in Miracles this time as saying, the world you see does nothing. It has no effects at all. It merely represents your thoughts. Pam then writes, CNN used to hire me every summer to write about new roller coasters, the really insane ones, the ones with the 85-degree vertical drops, the 7 inversions. They often have a camera right where the coaster plummets 185 feet. If you look at the photos these theme parks somehow manage to process and have waiting for you to purchase when you step wobbly-kneed off the ride, you notice teenagers have big smiles on their faces with their hands in the air. The adults, they look terrified, even though they know, theoretically, they're perfectly safe. Life is like those roller coasters. It sometimes looks like I'm in danger, but as lesson 286 reminds us, the time has come to laugh at such insane ideas. Nothing external to your mind can hurt you or injure you in any way. No one but yourself affects you. So, today I join the teenagers, put my hands in the air, shout with glee, even when the coaster appears to be heading downhill. So that's our Course in Miracles workbook lesson for today and our Course in Miracles experiment lesson from 286 from Pam Grout. And we have, as usual, about 50 minutes for a conversation. 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have that conversation. I was working a little bit more with the 15 Commitments to Conscious Leadership book, and I was struck by how the overlap and interplay between these books, teachings, mindsets. And as I've said quite often for quite a while, I find tremendous benefit in looking through the lens of how are these things similar. And it came to me as I was listening again to the second chapter or the second commitment in this work that this is how I'm going to talk, what I'm going to talk about today, the similarity between Guy Finley's work, Michael Rice's work, the ancient Aramaic process of forgiveness, Rilke's recommendation that we learn to live in the question. Because the second commitment is, I commit to grow in self-awareness. I commit to regard every interaction as an opportunity to learn. And I commit to curiosity as a path to rapid learning. Now, that is the above-the-line commitment. The below-the-line commitment is, I commit to being right and to seeing this situation as something that is happening to me. I commit to being defensive, especially when I'm certain that I'm right. Now, it's good to remind ourselves that their definition for commitment here is what actually is. The example they give at the top of the book is, every one of us, as we sit here listening to this, are absolutely committed to what we weigh right now, to the number of pounds or kilograms that register on a scale when we step on it. And a lot of people would say, well, no, that's not true. I don't like what I weigh, or I wish I could bulk up and put some more muscle on or whatever. But the fact of the matter is, their definition for commitment is that when I want to know what I'm committed to, I just look at what is. So they talk about four competencies that are they trump all other competencies when they research leadership. And these would be the best predictors of sustained success, not meteoric success, rise and crash, but sustained success. And those four competencies are self-awareness, learning agility, communication, and influence. The last two deal with how leaders interact with the world, and the first two address the leader's internal relationship to their own reality. Self-awareness and learning agility are what commitment two of the conscious leadership commitments are all about. They give an example of how several times a year they hold a retreat to introduce successful leaders to these 15 commitments. And they give an example of this woman, Sarah, who was wildly successful. But the more she got feedback from the participants, the more angry she got. And eventually, by the end of the second day, she left the retreat. And when she did, the entire retreat breathed a sigh of relief. She was incredibly successful, and she'll probably continue to be successful in her next venture. Also, she's still relatively young, so she'll likely have the opportunity to develop some skills in these two internal areas. But in their experience, her style of relating to feedback by rejecting it and getting defensive and insisting that she's right and the other people are wrong does not lead to long-term success. So if I'm stuck on being right, I commit to being right and to seeing this situation as something that is happening to me, and I commit to being defensive, especially when I'm certain that I'm right. So quite possibly no other commitment or trait is more central to the core of unconscious people than the need to be right. Well, let's look at the similarities between this and the reality management worksheet, where it says several times in the worksheet, and what I've said over and over again in the forgiveness patter addendum to the worksheet, I cancel my need to be right. I cancel my need for anyone or anything to change, including me. And I ask to be shown the hidden part of my mind. I ask to be shown another way to look at this situation. I ask to be shown some level of connection to insight, intuition, and creativity that can show me something that my conscious, logical mind and all of its need to be right cannot show me. Now, they understand that our brains are hardwired for self-preservation, and so this idea of wanting to be right comes from this basic need to survive, and that's okay at a survival level. But the fact of the matter is most of us that are functioning today are not worried about physical survival in life-threatening situations. They try to clarify here that being right isn't the issue, but the wanting to be right and the fighting to be right and that the idea I'm going to prove that I'm right, that's the issue. So when talking to a group, we often illustrate this by asking everyone to think about a simple, unarguable arithmetic axiom. Pick one that you know is right, and many people come up with 2 plus 2 equals 4. Right? And then we ask them how attached they are to being right about this rule, 2 plus 2 equals 4. And usually they observe, they have very little energy for arguing about this because they absolutely know it's right. There's no part of them that thinks they need to defend that. And next, we ask the same leaders to bring up to mind an issue that they're fighting to be right about and work out in their private lives. It doesn't take them long to find one. When we invite them to notice the difference between their need to defend, justify, and explain why they're right about that particular issue and how strongly they feel the need to defend 2 plus 2 equals 4, they often get an insight. Usually they discover two things. First, if they're honest with themselves, they'll see that they aren't nearly as certain about the rightness of their viewpoint. Second, they realize that wanting to be right and wanting to be seen as being right and being validated and appreciated for being right are really what they want. When they identify that this attachment is all about the ego, it gets easier to let it go. What is actually right doesn't need to be defended. The equation 2 plus 2 equals 4 doesn't require us to fight about its validity. So, above the line commitment in this second commitment about curiosity is staying open, curious, and committed to learning regardless of the situation. The below the line, the unconscious position is being closed, being defensive, and being committed to being right. When we're open, curious, and committed to learning, we're above the line. What they talk about is how, in their experience, conscious leaders choose to spend a lot of time above the line in those high learning states. This is called learning agility. It gives them a competitive edge since most of the people today are knowledge workers. In contrast, unconscious leaders spend much of their time trying to be right, defending their ego, and being defensive. And they could highly benefit from the reality management worksheet, which routinely has them practicing the skill of canceling their need to be right and learning to live in the question, learning to live in that curious state. The next thing they talk about is the concept of shifting in this work. Shifting is their critical skill because nobody is above the line all the time. The most important skill to learn is decide, am I actually being conscious, open, creative, curious, with learning agility in place, or am I getting stuck, trying to defend my position, trying to claim that I'm right, trying to get others to validate that I'm right? So shifting is what happens when I recognize I've drifted below the line. Well, you know, conscious leaders go below the line a lot. The difference between a conscious leader and an unconscious leader is the conscious leader wakes up sooner, recognizes that they've drifted to a below the line, to a negative, hurtful commitment, and then they shift back to the more open, productive space. So they create the drift-shift model. And what happens is when I stay awake and aware, I get to notice when I drift away from that positive commitment to openness, to honesty, to curiosity, to agile learning. And I recognize when I'm in a drift, and then I make a shift. Presence, as they call it, can be many things. Being in the flow, being awake, being conscious in the moment. Gay Hendricks, one of their mentors, says that most people, in the current worldview can stay in that presence, awake, aware state for about 4 seconds. At that point, something happens, could be anything. And we love the phrase, something happens, because it's so benign. The something can be a car cuts us off on the freeway, or we get a new email in our inbox, or our wife frowns at us, or a thought of worry or anxiety flashes through our mind. Something shifts, and we drift away from the active presence and alertness. We drift away from the positive commitment that we want to stay in. All leaders can resonate with the difference between being in presence and being in the drift. Getting triggered is another way to say in the drift. Examples of drifting or getting triggered look like blaming, concealing, worrying, complaining, getting tired or spaced out, correcting someone, ignoring someone, interpreting someone, explaining something that someone else has said, trying to be sarcastic, getting embarrassed, seeking approval, being misunderstood, feeling upset about being misunderstood, getting righteous in our defending of our position, drinking and drugging, eating what we don't need to eat, compulsively working, all of that. And there's a whole much longer list of things that they say, these are examples of drifting. These are examples that I have drifted, that I've become triggered in our terminology. And the issue for the leaders that they talk about in this book is not will we drift. Everybody drifts. Everybody gets triggered. Everybody's got their blind spots. The difference between a conscious leader and an unconscious leader is the unconscious leaders don't notice they're drifting, they don't recognize it's all an internal thing, and they don't shift back to presence or awakenedness. Conscious leaders have accepted themselves for being in a drift or a defensive state or a reactive state, and they ask themselves a second question. The first question is, you know, have I drifted? Am I still in presence? The second question is, am I willing to shift? And this is one of the most powerful questions you can ask yourself. When you're triggered, when you have any sense of frustration, tension, any of the negative emotions, and you recognize it, one of the most important things to do is call that time out. We say this over and over again. Take that calming breath that we talk about where I comfortably fill my lungs, hold it for 2 or 3 seconds, and then slowly exhale. If you've listened to the show for a while, you've heard me say that countless times. And then I can ask, am I willing to shift? Or I can ask, in our work, we say, how am I creating this emotion? Or we ask, what am I making this situation mean? And the focus of my attention is inside myself when I take that breath and I ask that question. So they go on to say, shifting is a master skill of conscious leaders. We find that they practice it the same way a professional golfer practices putting. Shift moves a reliable way to move from a closed to an open consciousness. A shift move can be put into two categories. There are those shift moves that we can make that change our blood and body chemistry, and shift moves that change our consciousness. When we are triggered, when we have shifted, when we are drifting, we're triggered, and we have a reactive blood chemistry, one which gets us ramped up on our way to the fight, freeze, flight, or faint response. And the first thing we need to do is shift our blood and body chemistry. And these first two moves that they talk about reliably do that. What's the first move they talk about? Conscious breathing. It's exactly the same work as we teach in Mind Shifters support groups and on Mind Shifters Radio. When I notice I get triggered, I call a timeout. I take that full, comfortable, deep breath, hold it for a few seconds, and slowly exhale. What's their definition of conscious breathing? Whenever we're in a threatened and defended state, we hold our breath or we breathe in a shallow way. A conscious breath shifts our breathing pattern and breaks the hold of our reactivity. When we take 4 conscious breaths with a 4-second inhale, a 4-second exhale, deep into our belly, we literally shift our blood chemistry and our breathing pattern. So the first step they recommend in shifting out of an unproductive pattern is exactly the same as we teach in this work. The second technique is to radically change our posture. Whenever we're defensive and more interested in being right than in learning, we each assume certain body postures. Most of us, with a moment's thought, can identify a defensive posture. Literally, defensive thoughts require our body to get tight, to get tense, to be in a defensive posture. So, by significantly shifting our posture, we shift out of defensiveness. And once we have shifted our biology and our neurology, now we are available to start shifting our perspective. Trying to shift our perspective while still being amped up on adrenaline and in that tight defensive response and trying to control things and having the cortisol course through our veins is almost impossible. This book is all about shift moves. Each chapter contains at least one. The shift move we want to introduce you to at this point is wonder. Wonder. Wonder is both a shift move and a state of consciousness. This is learning to live in the question, the way Rilke talks about it. This is what the Michael Rice Reality Management Worksheet calls asking to be shown the hidden part of my mind, turning it over to a higher level of my own consciousness or the Christ mind consciousness. Wonder is a shift move and a state of consciousness. Effective leaders learn to get into a state of wonder on a consistent basis. What is wonder? Well, to find out and to see it in action, we have to look no further than looking at a child. Before the age of 6, children are natural wonderers. It's as though they move through the world saying, I wonder what this is, or I wonder how this works, or I wonder how this tastes or feels or smells. I wonder what happens if I do this. Wonder is an open-ended curiosity. It's asking a question for which we don't know the answer, and we don't know or care if there is an answer. This is Rilke's learning to live in the question. Wonder is as much about the question as it is about the answer. And I don't know whether it's in Rilke's work or some other work, but we talk about, people ask, well, what do you mean, you know, learning to live in the question? We say, listen, anytime a mind can ask a really good question, the mind that asks that question is not capable of comprehending the answer. The mind that asks a really good question has to grow and expand, stretch through experience, through time, through the willingness to cultivate openness and questioning. And then it might someday live along into the answer, as Rilke calls it. In our experience, most leaders replace natural wonder with this, quote, figuring it out, close quotes. This is what Michael Rice calls the primary pseudo-solution of the non-being mind. I'm going to figure it out. It's a trap. It's a trap because of what David Bohm and Krishnamurti call sustained incoherence. Because when we use our conscious logical thought in our mental and emotional problem areas, it just creates more of what we're trying to get rid of. We only create our mental and emotional and psychological suffering because of our thought process being misapplied. And so when we apply it again and again and again, we just create more pain and suffering. We create more stuckness. I can't figure it out when I'm angry. I can't figure it out when I'm grief-stricken. I can't figure it out when I'm feeling righteous indignation. So wonder is almost the opposite mindset of trying to figure it out. Figuring it out presupposes that there is an answer and that the goal is to use the mind to figure it out. So here's this word puzzle. You can try to figure this out. Unscramble the following letters to form a word. N-E-I-C-E-S-N. To get a really good sense of what figuring it out energy is like for most leaders, you would need to set a timer and then give yourself a defined time to come up with the answer to this riddle. And in fact, you'd need to give yourself a very small amount of time, far less than you think you'd need. You would also need to make this a win-lose game with significant prize for winning and significant stakes for losing. If you've done all this, then you would have introduced anxiety and fear into the game, and then you will have replicated the standard business environment. That's what most people live in their business world. Your brain chemistry will respond accordingly with adrenaline surging through your system and cortisol and all kinds of other blood flow, respiration, and muscle tension changes. And then you get that sense of stuckness and fear-based response. And that's the opposite of wonder. Wonder is not really as much about learning as it is about staying open. By the way, the answer to that puzzle is incense, I-N-C-E-N-S-E. Wondering is a very different experience from figuring it out. It begins with a willingness to explore and step into the unknown. This involves taking a risk and letting go, which for most of us these days is not an easy commitment. Once we're willing to be surprised by the unknown, the next step in accessing wonder is to ask a wonder question, an open-ended question that has no right answer. So wonder questions go beyond our current knowing and beyond our past experience. They even go beyond our current paradigms. So highly committed, conscious leaders make it a practice to generate wonder-type questions. Here are a few examples of wonder questions. I wonder what outrageous customer service would look like. Or, I wonder what I can learn today that will benefit everyone. Or, I wonder how we could get more done in less time. Or, I wonder what choices I could make today that would allow me to experience greater and greater fun and creativity. Or, I wonder what I could do today that would allow for a breakthrough in my life. Or I wonder what I can learn from the issue that just keeps coming up with my partner that would expand and improve and deepen the connection in our relationship. Or I wonder how abundance is already showing up in my life that I'm not noticing. Conscious leaders practice asking questions like this. Conscious leaders are passionately committed to also doing the next piece of this commitment, dedication to self-awareness. Conscious leaders are passionately committed to knowing themselves more and more deeply. This is the basis of their willingness to, quote, regard every interaction as an opportunity to learn, close quotes. And their willingness to source a state of curiosity and wonder is fundamental to this. An astute person once said that all information falls into three buckets: what I know, what I know that I don't know, and what I don't know that I don't know. Though conscious leaders have a good grasp on what they know, and they're interested in what they don't know, they're powerfully drawn to what they don't know they don't know. And when it comes to self-awareness, they spend their time in the unknown by opening themselves up to feedback. Now, when most people think of feedback, they think of written or verbal comments given in a performance review. For us, feedback is much more than that. Feedback is information coming to us from a limitless set of sources. For example, our bodies are giving us feedback all the time in the form of sensations and feelings, as well as perceptions and thoughts. People are also giving us feedback all the time, and the vast majority of it is never verbalized. One of our favorite and most reliable forms of feedback is whatever the results are we're getting. The results in our lives give us immediate feedback about what we're committed to at an unconscious level. We said in the first commitment that radical responsibility is looking at your results to see what you're actually committed to. The source of feedback in this case is a direct channel to powerful self-awareness. So here is an example of this commitment in action. They gave an example of this woman leader, very successful leader, who attended a retreat they had. And she was angry and bitter and defensive and, you know, walked out of the first day, the first afternoon, and didn't come back. And the second day she came and walked out halfway through the day and left the whole retreat. In the midst of her being defensive, she directed her anger at a woman named Diana, telling her, "I don't believe that you live this conscious leadership stuff, and I'll tell you why, because your body shows that you lack discipline." Sarah didn't appear to be speaking from love or from respect, but from fear and self-righteous anger, and she was probably trying to hurt Diana. Now, it would have been easy for Diana to blow off this comment and let it go. But what we've noticed is that skilled, conscious leaders make the commitment to learning from all feedback, regardless of how it's given. Indeed, they learn that the feedback they most react to has the most learning potential. So again, this is directly out of what we try to teach in the Mindshifter Support Group, what we hear from Guy Finley. Guy Finley says, "The lessons we need to learn in life ride into our lives on the back of events we don't want. And the importance of a lesson for me is directly proportional to how much I don't want the event. So the more I have distaste for and upset and sadness and anger about an event unfolding in my life, the more important the lesson is in that moment for me. And if I reject the event, I lose the lesson. I can't learn the lesson, and at the same time, I reject life and reject the unfolding event." So Diana, in this example, is a master at this. For this reason, it didn't surprise people in the conscious leadership group when several weeks after that seminar, after that retreat, Diana posted the following message in their group. She writes, "When I was at the last foundation retreat, I got feedback from one of the participants that my body looked like I don't have the discipline I should have, especially around food. So I got really curious about the feedback. First, I giggled inside thinking that if this other person knew how much I want to eat versus what I am allowing myself to eat, she would be in awe of my discipline. Food is ecstatic to me, and my lusty personality wants more, more, more. Then I got curious about what gift she was giving me, regardless of the fact that she was saying it with anger and with the intention to hurt, and she was trying to be insulting. She was coming from a defensive, bitter position. Despite that, I looked for what gift she was giving me. And I found that there was a whole new layer of discipline that I could be experiencing around eating and caring for my form. So I have used this woman's voice as a wonderful challenge and have devoted myself to a whole different kind of discipline. It's not willful, but instead it is devotional. The results are surprising in that there has been a significant difference in my sensitivity and my intuition, and they're both more markedly keen. And the shape of my body changing is wonderfully fun. So here's an example of someone who is committed to self-discovery, self-knowledge, self-awareness. She's committed to catching any presence of tension or defensiveness or negative emotion in herself and doing the things that help her shift. The first one is a conscious breath, or doing four conscious breaths in their idea. Nice full four counts in breathing, nice slow four counts out. Exhale and do that four times. The next shift is I shift my body position. I move into a more open, soft position. And the next thing is I turn the focus into myself and ask, what can I learn from this situation? So practicing this commitment to learning over being right. I cancel my need to be right, and I ask to be shown, what's mine to learn here? What might life, love, this moment, my fellow brother or sister, be teaching me in this next present moment? So what they tell people we need to do if we want to move into a more conscious space for ourselves, being a leader in our own life or being a leader for others, we need to learn to commit to learning over being right. We decide that even though we'll get defensive at times, we're going to make the choice to notice it as soon as possible and then make a shift using these shift tools like four conscious breaths and curiosity questions and change of body posture to break the cycle of defensiveness. We also decide that we'll consider everything in life as a learning opportunity. And we're going to learn to value learning above all else. What's recommended is that we tell key people in our lives that this is our new commitment, and we request their support and feedback. And then the next step is to ask myself routinely, regularly throughout the day, am I above or below the line? Gay Hendricks says most people spend, you know, when they get above the line, when they get conscious, when they have an awakened moment, it lasts about 4 or 5 seconds. So it's important for me to ask on a regular basis throughout the day, am I above or below the line? If I'm below the line, can I accept myself for being just where I am? And then if I'm below the line, I ask the most important question of all. Am I willing to make a shift? Am I willing to cancel my need to be right and ask to be shown something else? If I'm willing to shift, I take these breaths. I shift my posture. I ask a curiosity-type question, an open-ended wonder question. And if I'm really committed to this, I'll make a list of wonder questions and share them with the people close to me so I can create this community of questioning from that open space, the wide open wonder of a child, without trying to figure it out, without jumping back into the need to be right and defensive. So here's the summary. Both commitment one and two are really the foundation for learning to live in the world as a committed, conscious leader. Commitment one says, I'm done blaming and complaining, and I'm going to start to see myself as the source of my experience. Commitment two says, I'm going to value learning over being right. I'm going to value growing over the survival of my identity. And I'm going to choose curiosity and wonder. So if I stay in self-awareness, if I stay in that learning agility and that open questioning and wonder and commitment to learning and the commitment to catch my defensiveness and release it, to practice canceling my need to be right and asking to be shown something else, this is going to form a foundation for conscious leadership. Conscious leaders are passionately committed to knowing themselves. And this is the basis of their willingness to live in a state of curiosity. At any point, anyone is either above the line, open, curious, and committed to learning, or below the line, defensive, closed off, and committed to being right. Being right, in quotes, doesn't cause drama. But wanting to be right, wanting to be proven to be right, wanting to fight for what I believe is right, that's what creates the drama. Even conscious leaders get defensive like everyone else, and they regularly interrupt this natural reactivity by taking a breath, doing a shift move by those four breaths, or shifting their posture, and then asking a wonder question. The issue is not whether or not we will drift from consciousness to unconsciousness. The only issue, the only question is, how long will we stay in the drift before we decide to take action and shift back to conscious awareness? There are two kinds of shift moves, those that change our blood and body chemistry, such as conscious breathing and changing our posture, and those types that change our consciousness, such as speaking clearly and unarguably about just what can absolutely be known to be true, and speaking from that calm place and speaking from appreciation and gratitude, and then shifting to the wonder questions. So hopefully you can see some powerful similarities between their second commitment, actually their first and second commitment, and what we're trying to do in every reality management worksheet process, in every recognition of moving from, as Michael Rice would call it, a non-being state back to our true being state of love. This allowance, acceptance, surrender, humility, the intention to be aligned with the creative force as it wants to express uniquely through us, these are things that put us in that conscious leadership position, in what they would call being in presence, being above the line. Developing that presence, developing the awareness of when we have a shift, tuning into the feedback, and again, the primary feedback we get is from our own body, from our own physical energy system. The mental, emotional, and physical energy systems are constantly giving us feedback. The next most important area of feedback is the actual results we're getting in our lives. Do we have more connected, rewarding, gratitude-based, cherishing-based relationships with people? Are we getting good results in our business life, in our family home life, in our ability to, as Guy Finley would call it, be a good householder? The results we get are the most important feedback. And then another important level of feedback is to open ourselves and ask friends, family, close confidants to give us feedback, to let us know when they feel we are drifting away from that conscious awareness, when we are outside of our present conscious awareness, when we're outside of the loving feelings and the openness and the appreciation and the gratitude and the respectfulness. So that's my offering for today. We've got about 9 minutes left for anybody to raise a hand and say, is this making sense? Can you see some of the similarities between the commitment to conscious leadership and Michael Rice's work and Guy Finley's work? I've attempted to turn on the microphone. I believe this is Ellen.
Hi, Dr. Tim. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for sharing all that. There were a couple things in there that I found really helpful. The one is when you recognize that you've drifted, to ask yourself the question, am I willing to shift? Because I think naturally, you know, that unwillingness is there. I mean, that's our kind of a, like our conditioned position. It's just to stay where we're at because that's what we're most comfortable with. That's what we know.
And that's what's happened in the moment, right? So
right.
That's a powerful question because it's asking me, hey, am I willing to see what got triggered in me that made me move out of presence?
Right. And then the other piece was about the posture. And again, it's almost like the same thing, but in a physical way. Are you willing to make a shift physically, change your posture? Because when you were talking about that, I saw these different positions that I get into all the time that are very closed off. And so those two things right there, I think, are going to be very helpful for me. And then just the whole thing about, you know, just staying open and not limiting the possibilities of what the current situation could lead to, if you're open to it and if you're willing to make that shift. I'm in a situation where I have no idea what has happened to one of my cats. He just disappeared. And I find that, you know, of course my mind has been going through the whole program of, well, there's only so many things that could have happened to him. It could be this, it could be that, it could be that, you know, and then of course, you know, you think, oh, if that happened, right, you start going down all those rabbit holes. And, you know, I recognize, okay, don't go there, you know, but my mind, it's so interesting. My mind has some very strong suspicions, and I have to be willing to move away from that and just go to that place of not knowing. Because the truth is, I really don't know. I only have suspicions. And that's not helpful. That's not helpful in finding at all, is to stay in those suspicions. And, you know, and then, of course, I'm limiting myself also to the possibilities. You know, and the truth is, I may never see him again, you know, and I have to just be willing to live with that, you know, and be open to whatever may happen, and of course the learning, you know, I can keep asking myself, okay, so what is there in this situation that it's here to benefit me? Because I know there's benefit in every experience. And as sad as it seems, I know that there's great learning. You know, when you mentioned about like the harder something is, I think you said it was Guy Finley that said the harder something is, really the greater potential for you to benefit from it.
Right. The more important the lesson is. Right.
Yeah.
And let's say this, right? Let's say this a little bit more accurately so that you free yourself up from the conditioning of the culture. You said, you know, as sad as it is, or as sad as it seems, instead say, despite the intense sadness I can generate around this, it's also an opportunity to learn. It's also, right, if you state it in that way, I'm the one with my interpretation of the potentials. I'm going through all of these negative things that might have happened to the cat and how sad I'm going to be if I don't get to see it again. I'm the one that generates my sadness. And so right. If you just say it that way, it helps to, with this regulatory speech, program my mind to the actuality of how my sadness gets created. And it moves me out of victim mode into, this is something I'm experiencing. I'm experiencing deep sadness. What am I doing to create that? I'm experiencing the loss of one of my cats. How am I going to respond to that? And before we run out of time, let me say, before I throw it back to you to make your comments, what comes to me very strongly is to recommend that you use the gentle art of blessing multiple times a day in regard to your cat.
And what is that?
Well, you can go to the MindShiftersAcademy.org website and on the audio library page and scroll down. There's an interview I did with Pierre Pratervand about his book, The Gentle Art of Blessing, and his book, The 365 Blessings to Heal Myself and the World. It's this process that we can move into where we find the most loving, heart-centered energy we can, positive, seeing the person, the situation, the cat in its highest and best, living into its potential in safety and comfort and warmth and, you know, living into its innate intelligence, whatever that might be, and then send that energy and through that image that you hold and send that energy through your heart space out toward the other person or the situation.
Okay, if I do that, I feel the love for him and I send it to him, and I'm always just sending out that message to him that I love him, how much I love him. And so I have been doing that, and I feel like that he probably feels that, and so that's helpful. If he's still even here, I mean, I don't know. I don't, you know. He might have made his transition. But even, it doesn't really matter either way where he is, right?
Exactly.
I can still send my love for him.
Right. And you get the primary benefit of that exercise, right? You get to sit in the intense loving energy.
Yeah.
And that is so much different than all of the negatives and all the worry that you talked about generating.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for chatting in here at the end after the whole monologue. I'm glad to know that it was useful to you. I will mute you so you can listen into the second hour. I appreciate the call. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. And I'll welcome Jeannie Rice, who says she's here but doesn't yet have her microphone on.
Thank you. I appreciate you. I am here.
All right. Have a wonderful show.
Thank you. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Wednesday, October 13th, 2021. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581, and press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And Michael is away from the house here, so hopefully he will pay attention to the time and get dialed in. So we'll give him just a few minutes, and I will invite you to go to our website, which is whyagain, whyagain.org, and just meander around and look at all the things that are out there. Let me know if you find something that's not working or if you need to know where something is and you can't find it, and I will see what I can do to help you. You can drop me a line at Jeannie, J-E-A-N-I-E, at whyagain.org, and I'll get back to you. And while we're waiting on Michael to dial in, I will also just say I'm opening the website up as I speak. If you go down to events, you will see that, well, Michael's participating this Friday in a Divine Science Ministers Conference. It's just for the ministers. But you'll see that the flyer and information on the Mind Shifters and Stillpoint Breathing monthly online membership. You'll also see the 90-hour codependence to interdependence and responsibility communication. That's a self-study of 90 hours of information. And so we'll invite you to consider participating in either of those. I'm still, I spent over 2 hours working on the catalog yesterday to get it switched over, and I don't know what had happened, but I totally messed up the whole website, and Susan had to go out and reload it from the day before. So I'm starting over again on the catalog. So I will eventually get there.
Ouch!
And I see Michael has joined us, so welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart. You hadn't shared that about the website. Ouch. That's a bummer.
That happened right before I
don't even
the doctor yesterday.
Oh, really? Ouch. Another stress you didn't need.
Very true.
Well, I don't have any brain cells for what you guys do with the whole website thing, so it's beyond my comprehension, but thank you for having the brain cells and the willingness to move it forward. And welcome everybody to the show. Delighted that you're here. I'm actually out on the road getting ready to go get some more composted tree cuttings for our garden, take care of a couple of errands. And so I'm actually sitting under a tree. It's kind of a warm day here. I'm not sure. It's probably close to 80, sunny, beautiful, big white fluffy clouds in the sky, and the garden is doing really well, learning a lot about gardening, and so hope that that perhaps inspires you to bring that aspect of the circle of life, that aspect of being holy, having nothing to do with being down on your hands and knees, but rather whole, comprehending from every direction, every level. And I'm really appreciating the fact and enjoying the fact that I'm getting my hands in the soil and bringing that part of the game of life into my world. And we're talking about inherited patterns here and moving through the inherited patterns of our generations. And Richard's starting to comprehend that perhaps the issues that he had with his mother and his mother had were passed on to his daughter, and that he's starting to get into more willingness to start to look at these things and realize that unconscious patterns and unconscious behaviors really don't work. And there's, if you're following along with us, we're on page 130 in the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again and What You Can Do About It. We're doing a couple of paragraphs today, and by the end of the year, we'll have worked through to page 180, 181. Yeah, I guess it's 181, and we'll be finished. We're on 130 right now, so we've got another 50 pages to do the rest of October, November, and December. And the title or the subtitle of this particular section on inherited patterns, and it goes right back to the power person dynamic, is the chain of abuse. And a lot of people do not have any recall of what happened to them in the chain of abuse. A lot of people, and if you don't have any recall of your early years and what happened, just look at what you do under stress and you know exactly what happened in those early years. It's as simple as A follows B, you know, B follows A. It's, you know, it's just straightforward. The power person dynamic, my offering is, literally runs the behavior of the world. And the power person dynamic develops when we have a person in our life who has more power over our lives than we do, is not functioning as love, and we perceive it as survival. When those three things occur, it usually happens in the life of a child, but, you know, I remember working with a guy who was, I don't remember now, 60s, 70s, and he was in a store when it was robbed and a gunman, and he really thought he was going to be killed. It was survival. And the energetic dynamics of that whole situation really started to play out in his life. And so it's got nothing to do with age, but usually it happens with a child. So if recall isn't there, just observe yourself. Remember, we talk often about become the thinker apart from the thought, the feeler apart from the feelings, the actor apart from the actions. And just watch what your automatic decision forces you to do. You can say, I don't want to do this. I want to be loving and caring. But just watch when the stress is up and the chips are down. You know, there are three levels of behavior in the mind, in the automatic decision system. And then there's choice. Choice only comes when one can quiet the mind, quite literally be out of their minds, and bring in new energetic dynamics. Choice is the ability to bring in a new energetic dynamic to the mind. If abuse is the history, then bringing love into the equation rather than a sharp voice or an attack or a hateful look or whatever. And if you do those things under stress and you don't remember where they came from, absolutely go back to your first 5, 6, 7, 8 years, and there it is. That's where it came from. And so forgiving those dynamics allows choice to step into the picture. Under stress, or actually there are three levels of behavior that relate to the level of stress we're under. Which one is going to run us? If there's no stress, we'll do whatever we did to get along with our power person. When stress starts to build, we'll do whatever we did to resist and survive with our power person. When we become ultra-stressed, we'll do what our power person did to us that we hated the most. If you find yourself hating the things you do, saying, I don't want to do this, that's what you hated your power person doing to you. And notice you do it with no thinking whatsoever. It's bang. The stress is up. When ultra-stressed, it's just what takes over. So you can look back into your history and see exactly what happened by what you do under stress. And when you apply forgiveness, you remove those dynamics. And the more you apply forgiveness, the weaker the energy fields emanating from brain cells will become, and the more empowered to choose, the more empowered to bring in something that maybe your bloodline has never seen. And that's what we want to head in the direction of. So we see the picture in the on page 130 of the chain of abuse, and the printed part of it is, when we deny and suppress fear and hostility, we tend to impose it on others and both pass it on to and teach it to the succeeding generations. In this way, the experience of our true nature, love, is driven into the unconscious. And so the diagram shows, you know, love in the center of being and denied fear and hostility being pushed on to the next generation and from that generation pushed on to the next generation, and the child being whacked with the hammer of terror. Terrorized, yes, terrorized by the people who are committed to cherishing them. You know, there's a powerful story that Susan McDonald Tucker shared with us. She's a woman in St. Louis, Missouri, who's done this work for the last quarter century or so. And she shared with us on a show, several years ago, a person who was brought up with, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child, and they believed that the rod wasn't something you lean on, it was something you hit people with. And if you look at the rod, thy rod and thy staff, they come from me. It's something we lean on to, you know, you go up a hill with a rod or a staff. You don't beat people with it. But the that was what she was brought up with, and so she, you know, used the rod with her child. And they had a family tradition. And this family tradition, it shocks me every time I'm talking to a group, how many people, when I speak about this, go, yeah, that's what we had to do when we were kids. And that was when the child was about to be beaten, they had to go out and get their own switch. They had to go take a switch off a tree, find a stick, cut it off the tree, and bring it in for mom or dad to beat them. So it just added to the trauma. You know, how much trauma does a child go through just going out to look for a stick to be beaten with? I mean, now somebody says, well, we just tapped them on the butt. Excuse me, you beat them. You beat them. That's what you do with sticks. You don't have a stick in your hand as an adult unless you're going to threaten and beat a child, however severe or not severe. And, you know, the emotional concussions of that, even if the sting of the switch never hurt the child one bit, the emotional repercussions of being hit by the people that are there to cherish you is monumental in a child's life, monumental in a developing mind that just cannot comprehend why they're being hit. So she shared about a mother who said she stopped beating her child when she sent her child out to get a switch, and the child came back in, I forget exactly the age, five or six, boy was sent out to get a switch, and he comes back in with tears in his eyes and says, Mom, I couldn't reach any branches on the trees, so here, and he opens his little hand, and it's filled with rocks. He says, here, I brought these so you can throw them at me. What does a child learn when they're hit or verbally abused or shut down and not allowed to talk? You watch the message from someone who was never allowed to speak, and the message will be, don't you dare speak. Well, yeah, I want you to communicate with me, but don't you dare speak unless I approve of what you're saying. No, yes, I want to hear from you, but I only want to hear what I want to hear. Don't tell me the truth. Don't make me look at the truth. And we have a favorite movie that we suggest people watch. In fact, it's probably time for us to watch again. It's been a couple of years, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. And it's considered to be a movie about the television show, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. But in truth, it's a story about a reporter who was assigned to go and interview his name's not coming to me, Mr. Rogers. And he didn't want to do it, but he was forced to. And if you watch carefully, you'll see that Mr. Rogers, he's a space, and he's there to process and support people. And the main message, each time he gets close to anything that he doesn't want to look at, the main message this guy gives, at one point he's got an appointment with him, and he gets up and walks out of Mr. Rogers' office. And the main message is, don't make me look. You look at people, say, oh, you never talk to me. You should talk to me. So, okay, I'll talk. Well, wait a minute. I don't want you to use those. I don't want you to talk to me about that. Don't tell me the truth. Don't make me be accountable for what I'm doing, for the power person dynamics I'm doing. No, 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 no. Talk, but no, no. Just talk the words. Just say the words I want to hear. Well, you know, if you're going to invite somebody to talk, then you better be ready to listen. And if it brings something less than love, then maybe that's the space to step into healing those dynamics. And maybe you can let go of this, you know, I'm going to bring rocks in so that the person who's supposed to cherish me can throw them at me and hurt me. So we're talking to Richard about this whole dynamic, and I say to Richard, as you heal the issues with your mother, not only will your relationship with her improve, most likely your relationship with your daughter will shift as well, I assured him. He says, sometimes my daughter avoids me like the plague, and I've always wondered why. Now I think I know. She used to tell me I treated her poorly, but I never listened. I didn't see it that way. I guess my mom didn't either. Come to think of it, my mom used to brush me off the same way my daughter says I do her. Feels like a relief to know that I can do things differently and develop a more loving relationship with her. You know, I'm feeling pretty good. I think I might be feeling that empowerment feeling you were talking about earlier. For the first time in a long time, I'm feeling like I can do something about my life. Richard, my mind keeps going back to a thought I had when you were talking about the issues around your mom. Would you be willing to look at that? He spoke with hesitation. Oh, what the heck? I feel pretty good. Considering what I've been through today, if someone told me I could uncover and deal with events and issues of such proportions as I have and come out the other side with a smile on my face, I'd have said they were out of their minds. Recall that the key to process and healing is holding the space of love. Bring those issues to the surface in another setting, and it could lead to craziness, I acknowledged. Is this the kind of thing people do in your intensive workshops, he asked? That is the focus. In an intensive, we work to give the best tools and understanding possible. The rest is process. And it's like watching miracles happen when a number of people get together to do healing work, I replied. I know you wouldn't engage me in this conversation to avoid looking at an issue about that, I said with a chuckle. Are you willing? So notice that he talks about, well, I'm ready to look at some things, and then he changes the subject. Watch the mind. It's tricky at its games. I'm willing, he said, as a trace of fear flashed across his face. Have you ever thought that living with you might be like walking through a minefield? I inquired. No, of course not, came his indignant reply. Are you feeling a little defensive, Richard? Perhaps a little. And so let's just digest that information, and then we'll step into tomorrow the next level of the conversation with Richard as we invite him to look at deeper and deeper parts of his mind and recognize that defensiveness, attack, is a pretty normal part of stepping into parts of the mind that have been hidden. And so if that resonates any questions or thoughts for you, we'd love to hear your sweet voice. Our call-in number, if you're on one of those stations where we can't see you, is 563-999-3581. We've got 3/4 of the show left for conversation and questions. So if you're out there in listener land, and if you're on one of those stations where we can't hear you, if you call that number I just gave, you'll be listening to the show directly on your phone. And when you're doing that, if you push 1, that raises a hand in the phone queue, and we'll be having a conversation. So what's on your mind? How can we support you? 563-999-3581. Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody out there with anything happening in the chat room or a hand up in the phone queue?
No, it's all quiet. So we have 40 minutes.
Well, we're here for
somebody
conversation.
Press 1.
Say it again, sweetie.
As I said, we have 40 minutes. Somebody press 1.
Yeah, we've got lots of time for conversation today. Cut the monologue short so we can open some space. So if you're out there in listener land, what's up for you? Is this fitting? Is this process that Richard's stepping into making sense for you? Now, if I were in your hometown.
We have a hand up.
Great. Let's go for it.
Area code 541. You're on the air. Is this Julie?
Oh, yes. Hi.
Hey there. Welcome, young lady.
Yes. Julie from Ashland, Oregon.
We got it.
Hi. Well, I'm just going to give you a little feel for my experience of myself since I had the breathing session on the weekend on Saturday with you guys.
Oh, cool. Yes.
Yeah. I feel like I'm a lot more aware and able to observe my capacity to hold the space that I was in from that healing. It's more anchored into me now, and I notice that I make adjustments in my energetic whatever I'm resonating. All right, my energy resonates. I make adjustments for others, but I don't go into their energy as much anymore. I don't engage, and I don't fight. You know, I used to say I don't engage, like don't, you know, like, but there's a don't in there that's not. If I say I don't engage, I do. I'm learning the difference between engaging and allowing some sort of engagement at a level that I'm choosing to both allow for them to be where they are and keep where I feel I am. And there is no need for a fight about it, no need for a debate or an argument. I just simply include more, but I refrain from taking it on in order to have an experience. You know, it's like, well, in order to be true to that person and really get them, I must really get what they're trying to communicate and what they feel. I don't have to do it that way, but it's less effort. I can simply see and there's no need to correct or anything like that. It's just gone, and I'm so happy that that's lifted. And so I love from the space I'm in, which is the space of love, instead of trying to fit some picture I used to have of them or could have that they're projecting that they want me to have of them. Something like
right.
that, Michael.
Well,
something like that.
You know, what I hear you saying, and if you look at all the things that you're recognizing you're now able to drop instead of compulsively engage in,
mm-hmm.
are they the things that your power person used to do to you that you disliked? If you
probably,
think about it.
I've been thinking about those things. my relationship with my mother and father and their relationship with each other definitely, you know, something that I was in that environment, and I allow myself to see more about that, and I also have compassion for whatever the person across from me that I'm interacting with. You know, they had their mother and their father, and it didn't help but be impacted by it, and then they're replicating it. That's what I'm starting to see, the fact of them replicating the dichotomy between the mother and father, and just like I did, and they match. There's a match. I'm looking to see where do the energies match, and then what can I do to process. You know? Yes, thank you for asking.
Yeah. So what it looks like to me is, having handled some of those power person dynamics, forgiven literally the energetic dynamics of those things, having removed those energetic patterns from your own structure, you're free of them.
Yeah.
And so under stress, those aren't the instructions your mind comes up with, and you're able to introduce something that probably in the past was relatively inconceivable. Oh, here's this person who, you know, let's say maybe they're attacking me. And I can go, oh, they're attacking me. I wonder what's up for them, rather than bang, bring that power person dynamic back into their face. And that's like, that's a monumental piece of work to do. Congratulations. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I feel like I have a choice to choose a different way of thinking and seeing and being with it, whatever it is it presents. Yeah.
And again, that's exactly what choice is the ability to bring something new to the mind that perhaps the mind has never seen before, never engaged in, never conceived of.
Mm-hmm.
That's what real choice is. There's no choice in the mind. I mean, you know, what the mind would call choice is, well, you know, when I'm with my power person, I would either rage or cry. And so here I am in this situation 50 years later, stress is up and the chips are down, and I can either rage or cry, and I call that choice. But it isn't choice at all. That's just a decision. Which path am I going to take out of my past? But to bring in, to truly bring in something new is pretty huge. It's a nice work.
Yeah, it is. Well,
millions
thank you for...
yet unborn. Yeah, millions that... yet unborn will benefit from that piece of work.
Oh, good, good. It's a different way of bringing the change I'd like to see into the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the only way, really.
Sweet.
Now. Yeah. But so I'm really enjoying my life and moving at my pace that's comfortable and loving to me. And and I'm feeling more. I'm feeling my eyes healing, and I'm just letting them be. There's nothing wrong with them. You know, there's nothing except perception that needs to be healed, and that's an instinct.
You got it.
That's a miracle. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you recognize that perception comes from what's stored in tissue, when the disintegrative energies in tissue are removed, what we think of as tissue, what looks like physical disease, all of a sudden the energy changes and healing happens. So nice work. That's awesome.
Well, that's cool. Yes. That's funny. And I still have habits. Like, how funny this is. I have had a repeating condition from time to time, and then I have a prescription for it from time to time. And I'm getting low on my prescription. I've been telling myself, I better get more because I might need those. Well, but now I realized that last night I didn't want to get up out of bed to take the prescription. So I fell asleep. And this morning I went and took the prescription. But actually the condition had already changed for the better. So that's a little leftover residual habitual behavior, you know, that I put
right.
A little bit of into the medicine. And it's real interesting. There's no fear. There's just no fear either way. Yeah. But the Course in Miracles taught us that when we see ourselves as sick, we're having to create the sickness, and if we need to heal it, you know, we create the sickness first. And there's truth in that. But what you just said about how we put it into our tissue, you know, that's the way out.
And forgiveness is the act of literally developing the skill. What's developing the skill to be able to literally reach into the cell and remove the neuropeptide that's creating the so-called chemistry of the disease in the cell. And as I remove that energetic pattern and I learn to decode it, because it's made up of mind energy, when I can bring that forward in the presence of love, that's when the dissolution occurs. My mind shifts and changes, and my physiology does the same.
Mm-hmm.
So
say
good work, young lady.
Again. That's so good. Can you say that all again?
I don't know. That was so long ago, but I'll try. So remember, we've talked about what the cell biologists are telling us. You think a thought, the thought becomes a molecule called a neuropeptide. So literally, we have something we call non-physical becoming what we call physical. So the thought shows up in the structure as a molecule, this neuropeptide. The neuropeptide now circulates around in the structure until it finds a cell that matches its frequency, a cell with a receptor site that matches. And it's interesting, you know, they used to think it was all on the inside of the cell, but what they found is you can go in and you can remove all of the insides of the cell, and if the receptor sites are still there, the cell will function just fine. If you use enzymes to digest the receptor sites on the cell, you can leave the guts in the cell and the cell won't function properly. There has to be communication with the cell. So if I come up with a thought that matches a receptor site, then that cell, that neuropeptide, lands on the receptor site. And if you imagined an antenna, you know, the signal is landing on the antenna, and as it lands, it simultaneously inserts its structure into the cell. If you were inside the cell looking, you know, up at the receptor sites that this energy is coming in into, it would look like, as it shows up inside the cell, it would look like chemistry. That's what we'd call that frequency. The truth is, seeing as how, you know, Einstein tells us there's no such thing as matter, there's no such thing as chemistry. But we call it chemistry on the level where our mind builds perception and our brain cells are there to see it that way. So now I've got a piece of mind energy, let's say hate. It shows up in the cell as a disease energy, a disintegrative frequency in the cell. The skill of forgiveness is developing the ability to recapture, and instead of have that thing hide away in the cell, produce all kinds of emotion of rage and fear and behaviors based on unconsciousness in the cell, I'm getting conscious, I'm canceling the goals, I'm becoming aware, I can decode what's in my own cellular structure, I can reach into that cell, I can pull that neuropeptide back out and go, oh my God, I never thought of myself as having hatred. Whoa, I'm going to take a breath and let loose of this. And so I'm literally, you know, if you imagine reaching into the cell, pulling the chemistry, and it's coming back to where I'm converting it, I'm becoming aware of, oh, this is the chemistry, a thought based in hatred. And I'm ready to be finished with hatred, so I bring that hatred forward, expose it to love, and it dissolves. Literally, hatred dissolves from the cell. The cell is now free to totally and completely reorganize itself, literally become a new organic structure, free of hatred, and literally, physiologically, restructure itself in the image and likeness of the control frequency it was designed for, and that is love. And it's forgiveness that does that. So the skill we're inviting people to do with this work, and it takes time. It takes building brain cells to recognize, and you know, oftentimes one of the most common things we'll hear, people touch into that, and they're like, I never knew I had any of that in me. I don't ever remember that happening. And what they're literally doing is developing that skill and that ability to go in and pull the neuropeptide out of the cell, pull the chemistry out of the cell, what's called chemistry, and poof, disappear it. The cell, freed of the influence of that disintegrative mind energy, is free now, literally, energetically, to reorganize itself, to literally become something new organically. And it's forgiveness that allows that.
And, Michael, also, I was thinking that neuropeptide thought, like you said, I really listened to this time about how it circulates through our system and finds a receptor site to take, right? Mm-hmm. And when we do the forgiveness work, we may do the forgiveness work enough to release the cell from that peptide. And yet, if we don't fully heal it, it can find another receptor site. And I've had things move around in my body from left to right or whatever, or go away and come back. And just so that just means I haven't done enough of my layers of forgiveness. Is that correct, the way I'm thinking?
I think you're right. You're right on target. Okay. You're right on target. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, cool. And then if I choose or decide or become a victim to immersing myself in the neuropeptide thoughts that I was getting from the television, for example, then there they are. Then my system attach or receive. So
there's not a lot of respect that I have for. Say it again.
What? I said I'm.
Go ahead. Say it again.
Okay, I'm literally feeding myself those things, those neuropeptides.
Yes. digesting mm-hmm. them, literally metabolizing them.
Mm-hmm.
So the Greeks, and it's, you know, there's not much about Greek philosophy that I really admire, but one piece that they had of the puzzle, very powerfully, is they said, guard the portals of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Watch what you allow your mind to metabolize. And make sure that the mind energy you gather from the world, it's like a harvest, make sure that as you reap from the world, you recognize that what you reap, and it kind of is the reversal of that law of, they say, as you sow, you reap. Well, in this case, it's as you reap. If I'm reaping rage and hatred and fear, if I'm focused on all that in the culture, and I'm reaping that mind energy from the culture, I'm sowing that in my literal cells. And my cells mm-hmm. are going to move in the direction of that frequency. That's why, and they call it aging, but the truth is it's got nothing to do with time. There's no such thing as aging. Who was it? I forget who it was that did some research. At the Kersey Clinic in Cincinnati, and here's what they said. Time is not toxic. Time has no effect on human tissue under any conditions. It is the belief in the effects of time by those who subscribe to such a belief that acts as a poison. So we do this, you know, we sit in front of the tube and, you know, here's this set of symptoms coming in from the drug ad, and here's this set of symptoms and that set of symptoms, and people run off the doctor like, well, I wonder which symptoms I should deal with first. And they're literally reaping those frequencies, don't have any idea that they're allowing that mind energy into their minds, and wondering why they're becoming symptomatic. Because they've, in reaping them with their sensory awareness, they're sowing those frequencies into their tissue structure. It's been called suggestion or the placebo effect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's a thing called the nocebo effect, the negative aspect. And when people buy into the negative aspect, they grow into a likeness of their diseases. There's the thing that they've recognized in schools of medicine and psychological studies, and they call it the second-year syndrome. And by the second year of studying a particular set of symptoms, what they've noticed is that the medical students that are studying those symptoms are developing those diseases. They're literally growing into the image and likeness of that which they've focused their minds on.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So to refuse to engage in that is, I mean, we usually in the evenings now sit with Jeannie's dad and we'll watch television with him, and we try to watch things without commercials, but sometimes they end up there or he watches them and, you know, we hear him from the other room, and it's like, a continuous canceling of, well, cancel that image. Like, who needs to buy that? You know, oh, the XYZ drug. See if it's good for you. If your doctor thinks this is right for you, and then they've got this whole list of, you know, body parts that are going to break and, you know, life-threatening. You know, you got a pimple on your nose. We get rid of that pimple. Well, it may cause a heart attack, but hey, ooh. Like engaging, reaping that energy from the TV set is a disaster. And many people, I would say, die because they watch so much television and buy into so much crap.
Yep. Hey, this thing came while you were talking earlier. The word frequency, okay? Mm-hmm. When I hear that, and I was holding my phone right up to my ear and just hearing and absorbing, like, I heard the word freak, like F-R-E-A-K, freak.
Right.
Okay. And so I wrote it down, and then, you know, it's, which do you want, that kind of frequency, or do you want the kind, and I wrote down the positive one. I didn't know what it was going to be. So I spelled the word free, F-R-E-E, and then Quincy. So that's what forgiveness is it frees us up for the harmonious frequency.
Shift the mind energy patterns. It's the key to it all.
Mm-hmm.
And most people are not interested in working with and in their minds. Oh, that's irrelevant. That's just in his mind. Excuse me. If it's in his mind, it's in his body. And if it's in his body, it's going to pay the price of it being there. And yep. Again, forgiveness is about developing the skill and the ability to reach into the cell, pull the neuropeptide out, decode what's there, and throw it away. The act of throwing it away is forgiveness. And if we refuse to do that, then life is designed to deliver to us someone who has the decoder. Somebody's going to show up and play it out with us. And my take is that's a gift that life gives us. It's going to show it to us over and over and over again until we finally go, this keeps going on in my mind. Maybe this is about me. Maybe I need to take charge here and do something about it. Mm-hmm. And that's where the game changes.
Yeah. And that's the eternal, too. I mean, we can live eternally now. We can feel our eternity and truth of our essence now. And as we walk in the world, the experiences that present to us, we call in, right? We call in. Then we continually undo what doesn't belong in our system and keep walking in eternity, I guess.
That's the idea.
Anyway, it sounds like
I join you in that,
time.
Young lady.
But what else is there to do? Live the highest.
Once you realize it's there to be done,
mm-hmm.
I agree with you. What else is there to do?
And, oh, by the way, did you see William Shatner on his launch into space and his arrival back here on Earth?
No, I didn't.
It happened today. And
really?
Wow. Yes, he's a spokesman for let's take care of this beautiful treasure of Earth. It was so profound to him, and he's pretty emotional. Anyway, he's able, as an actor, you know, he's able to emote from emotion and convey his acting. And he's articulate on his own two feet. And but that, you could tell, that experience was so something to him. It was hard to get his words, no matter how prepared he was.
Cool. Well, I'll have to look that up. Thanks for letting me know. I mean, after all those years of being in outer space on spaceships to actually do that, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
He had a real message. And he basically, one of the messages was he wishes and hopes that every person could have that experience. You know, because it changes our perception, right? And what we're, you know, I think he is an advocate anyway for taking care of our planet better and respecting.
Cool.
Yeah.
Sweet. I'll look
up.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. I guess if there's anything else, I might as well just be blessed and listen now. And thank you for letting me share. And thank you.
All right, young lady, you have a blessed one. Nice work.
Thank you for enhancing, help to the next step. Thank you. All right.
All right. Blessings. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Miss Jeannie, we're down to about 16 or so minutes. So we've got lots of time for conversation. Anybody out there in the phone queue with a hand up or anything else happening in the chat room? Are you mute challenged?
There are no other hands up and no questions in the chat room.
Chat room's been pretty quiet lately. We're not hearing much from the chat room the last few months. So if you're out there in listener land, what's on your mind? How can we support you? 563-999-3581. Just call the number if you're on one of those stations where we can't see you. If you dial that number, push one, we'll be having a conversation. What's on your mind? How can we support you? And the object of this show is to have a dialogue based on the monologue and based on the principles. So if you got something that we can support you with, If so, push one. Let's have a conversation. If not, I have plenty on my list for today, and I'm going to call the show, and I'm going to move forward and do my list.
I think a hand just went back up. I'm not sure it flickered,
great.
But I think Julie pressed her. I think 541. Did you press one again?
Mm-hmm, I did. Thank you. I know you might want to go work on your garden, but if you like, I could tell you some more things I'm remembering about William Shatner. Now.
Say it again.
It's pretty profound.
I didn't hear your last sentence. Oh.
It's some things that I remember now that William Shatner was saying about his space experience. And in case, you know, you never know if you're going to get the whole everything he said, you know, when you go look for him. I don't know what you'll find. But can I tell you one more thing?
Go for it. Tell us what's
okay.
It's kind of shocking to hear that he actually went into space. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, he did. I'm so glad I caught it. It was with Jeff Bezos, his company, Blue Origin, or I don't know what he really called
right.
his company, but that name was on the spaceship. It was a booster and a capsule. And so as the booster and capsule went up and then the booster released, it stayed in its own return curve, which was in the lower, atmosphere.
Atmosphere,
yep.
Right.
The atmosphere, and then the capsule went on from all that momentum into space, and its arc allowed them to be weightless for 3 minutes, and then they started their descent. And what I was really surprised of was that the booster actually landed on its own to be used again. This was its fourth use, and they came
uh-huh.
down with parachutes later and landed right on the desert floor. It was in Texas. And so that was amazing, just all of that science. And then,
that is pretty amazing.
Yeah. And it happened this morning, like around, I guess it was 10 a.m. Eastern time, maybe Texas
uh-huh.
time. It was 8 a.m. here. It was before 8, between 7:30 and 8 on the West Coast. Anyway, they had a delay, you know, and then they finally went, and the countdown happened, and, you know, so when William Shatner got back, he was telling about what his experience was, sitting there in the capsule, waiting to go, because he was already emotional and nervous and wondering, you know? I mean,
right.
you gotta be. So then, you know, nothing is quite what the simulator ever could convey, so the engine started, and that was huge. And then the liftoff started, and that was huge. And he was really wondering with all those G's, am I going to make it? Am I going to make it, you know? Anyway,
yeah.
This is the profound part that just he was so surprised he didn't expect. So they get to this place where it changes from blue to black, right there, that instant. And they're going, I guess, 50,000 miles an hour or 50 feet per second or something like that, something 50.
Pretty
and
fast,
he said
whatever it was.
The effect that had on him to look at the beautiful blue and then to have it disappear and become nothing but black, he felt like it was like the difference between life and death.
Hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, he's older, 90. He probably thinks about, you know, what's happening next, you know. And, of course, it's what we create. And anyway, so he just couldn't get over that. Other astronauts described it as, you know, oh, it's an open expanse, spaces to be explored, you know. But, and with all those shows and all that programming and all those scripts of Star Trek, his experience was, that's a simple and quick as life and death. So, but I think it then to it, the meaning, the profoundness of that was meaning there's just that thin membrane, the difference between our life on Earth and it not being here because we didn't take care of it. That's where he really was impacted.
Right.
So, Anyway, I just wanted to get that across in case anyone else missed it and you don't mind it being on your show. So thank you.
That's great. Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't realize that he was 90 in terms of the number of times he's traveled around the sun. And you don't usually think of someone who's been around the sun 90 revolutions going into space. You know, it's always the young man or the young woman's game. So pretty amazing. Pretty amazing.
Really, and actually, I don't think they didn't. It was very short. I think it took 10 minutes altogether, maybe 15.
Yeah.
Because they didn't go all the way around like in a huge orbit. They just hit that level of something like 62 miles up or something. And then it was amazing, though.
Amazing.
And the camera, the footage that we got to see from all parts of the capsule and the booster and the landing and just. It was just amazingly done.
That's pretty cool.
Okay. Yeah, it is.
All right, young lady. You have a blessed one. All right, take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Well, let's make one more call for a hand up. If you're out there in listener land and you have a comment or a thought, anything we can support you with, anything you want to know about the tools, you know, you can go to our website, whyagain.org, and if you go to the up in the upper left-hand corner of the homepage, you'll see a link that says start here. It'll walk you through the whole forgiveness process. You can do the process right there on the website. You can download the worksheets and print them. You can go to your app store and download, you know, type in the search term, Heartland, H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, Aramaic, A-R-A-M-A-I-C, forgiveness. And you'll be looking at the world's only forgiveness app. And if we have no other conversation or questions, thoughts, then I'm going to say thank you for being with us and create the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mindshifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.